the Food Not Bombs Radio Network.
And as far as I'm concerned, the gay folks out there, you know, they are exactly like the Jews who were marshaled into the concentration camp gas chambers by the millions with the same attitude, oh, this could not be happening. And in fact, it's the same people with the same agendas virtually, with the same money behind it, that claim the same thing, that this they're going into those gas chambers for, quote, disinfection, public health. Well, you know, in my opinion at this point, it's like people who don't have eyes to see and ears to hear this information, in my opinion, deserve in their ignorance to succumb to whatever their choices lead them to. And if they want to walk into the concentration camp, gas chambers, which today, in my opinion, are the public health settings in the physicians' offices, and the vaccines are like the gas of yesteryear, then you guys go right ahead, because as far as I'm concerned, you know, you are brainwashed and brained dead.
Coming up on the Food Not Bombs Radio Network, an interview with Dr. Leonard Horowitz, author of Emerging Viruses, AIDS and Ebola, Nature, Accident, or intentional.
You reckon hell who leave me out. When me you fly, I am the wings. The most dangerous road in the world, for it is a journey beyond death, beyond the basic God standard of fear and danger. It is the most heavily guarded road in the world.
I'm Richard Edmondson. This is the Food Not Bombs Radio Network. Did the U.S. government create HIV as a biomedical weapon of destruction? Though often dismissed as just another conspiracy theory, this question has nonetheless lingered since the mid-1980s, when reports appeared in newspapers in Great Britain, the Soviet Union, and India, and in a gay publication, The New York Native, in the United States. The major media responded at that time with a few brief denunciations of the story. Time magazine, for instance, in its November 17, 1986 issue, labeled the reports infectious propaganda, while the Los Angeles Times, which a decade later would lead the charge against reporter Gary Webb in the San Jose Mercury News, published a story under the headline, Soviet Sponsor Spread of AIDS Disinformation. Following this brief flurry of denials, the whole issue simply disappeared off the media radar screen. Now, though more than a decade has passed, still questions about a possible U.S. government role in the AIDS Holocaust have not gone away. Indeed, they have intensified. In 1988, Dr. Alan Cantwell, a Los Angeles cancer researcher, published his book, AIDS and the Doctors of Death. In 1993 came Cantwell's seminal work, Queer Blood, The Secret AIDS Genocide Plot. And in 1996, perhaps the most explosively incriminating work yet to come along, appeared with the publication of Emerging viruses, AIDS and Ebola, nature, accident, or intentional, by Dr. Leonard Horowitz. Coming up today on the Food Not Bombs Radio Network, we bring you part one of an interview with Dr. Horowitz. One key item in the body of evidence linking the U.S. government to AIDS is the testimony of one Donald MacArthur before a congressional subcommittee. MacArthur, now dead, was deputy director of the Pentagon under former President Richard Nixon. On July 1, 1969, MacArthur testified before a House Subcommittee on Appropriations at a hearing on chemical and biological warfare. During that hearing, MacArthur said, and I quote, "Within the next 5 to 10 years, it would probably be possible to make a new infective microorganism which could differ in certain important aspects from any known disease-causing organism. Most important of these is that it might be refractory to the immunological and therapeutic processes upon which we depend to maintain our relative freedom from infectious disease. A research program to explore the feasibility of this could be completed in approximately 5 years at a cost of $10 million." Unquote. MacArthur's comments are recorded verbatim in a U.S. government document entitled Department of Defense Appropriations for 1970 House of Representatives Subcommittee HB 15090, on page 129. The response of the media to the obvious questions raised by this peculiar testimony has been a thunderous silence. What kind of research program exactly was the deputy director of the Pentagon putting together? What exactly was MacArthur describing when he talked about a microorganism that would break down the immunological and therapeutic processes upon which we depend to maintain our freedom from disease? What disease appeared in the world within 10 years? Right on schedule, that differed from all other known diseases in that it attacked the immune system? What on earth was being created that day in 1969? If not AIDS, what was MacArthur talking about? There may be perfectly logical explanations for these questions, but if so, what are they? Perhaps MacArthur's research team was working on something completely and utterly benign. But if so, what was it? Why the deafening silence from the government and the major media? Since the U.S. government has chosen to ignore these questions, we put them to Dr. Leonard Horowitz. This interview took place on June 19, 1997, in the studio of San Francisco Liberation Radio.
The closest thing going to the human AIDS virus is the simian immunodeficiency virus from the chimpanzee. Okay? And I show you that it was contaminated chimpanzees that Merck Sharp and Dohme researchers, along with FDA and CDC, used to create the vaccine that most plausibly delivered AIDS to the world. Now,
are you talking about the hepatitis B vaccine?
Right. Specifically the 1974 experimental hepatitis B vaccine. Now, there's a fellow from a Harvard AIDS Institute who runs there. He was in this town in San Francisco 2 years ago in 1995 for the National AIDS Update meeting. His name is Max Essex, and I attended that meeting. And at that meeting, in front of all of your reporters, including San Francisco Chronicle, I asked Dr. Essex, "Dr. Essex, you're the one who discovered the HIV-2, the second human AIDS virus, which he found them in Senegalese women, prostitutes, in Western Africa. Later, science proved that this was a monkey virus that did not exist in monkeys in the wild. It only existed in laboratory animals. So my question to Dr. Essex in front of your most esteemed AIDS reporters in this city was, Dr. Essex, could you please explain how, other than through contaminated vaccines, could a monkey virus that does not contaminate monkeys in the wild, does not exist in monkeys in the wild, only laboratory monkeys, get into Senegalese female prostitutes? And you know, he hemmed and he hawed and he wouldn't answer my question. And ultimately, when I pressed him, here's what he told me. And this will show you what the level of biohazard that currently exists, even at the Harvard AIDS Institute. He says, I can tell you how my monkeys got contaminated with HIV too, he said. Mine were shipped to me contaminated. My monkeys were shipped to me contaminated by the monkey suppliers who had received them after they had previously shipped them to other researchers in other areas who had then used those monkeys through other experiments unrelated to AIDS, and they had inoculated those animals with human tissues. So isn't that nice? The monkey suppliers, including Litton Bionetics in the old days, were shipping used contaminated animals to the finest medical research, virology, cancer research institutes, and vaccine production facilities in the world. And that's precisely what I point out in the book Emerging Viruses, AIDS, and Ebola, that these were accidents waiting to happen.
So they grew the viruses in these contaminated monkeys and then made vaccines out of them, and then injected the Senegalese prostitutes.
That's exactly what my strongest thesis on HIV-2 is, that indeed, it's exactly the only thing that could explain it. Don't forget, in Senegal, prostitution is legal, and hepatitis B is a sexually transmitted disease and bloodborne pathogen, and that these women most plausibly were involved, enrolled in a state-funded, promoted, World Health Organization and probably USAID-promoted vaccine program for hepatitis. And so again, you see that the hepatitis B vaccine is implicated.
That same experimental hepatitis B vaccine was administered to 1,000 gay volunteers in New York City beginning in 1978 under a program carried out by the New York City Blood Center. The following year, the same program was carried out in San Francisco and later in other U.S. cities. If vaccines were the vehicle by which HIV-2 entered the bodies of Senegalese prostitutes in Africa, could HIV-1 have been introduced into Manhattan and San Francisco gays in the same way? The hepatitis B trials, coming as they did just prior to the onset of the AIDS epidemic, would tend to point an incriminating finger. And if these vaccine trials were indeed the guilty culprit, was the infection of gay men an accident or was it intentional?
Well, given the, you know, it's really hard to say. I always said it was six of one, half a dozen of the other. If you had to give you my bias on it at this point, and I say bias because I don't have a document from Henry Kissinger saying that he ordered this virus to be deployed in the hepatitis B vaccine to target out and take out gay men and blacks in Central Africa.
Yeah, but I don't have solid concrete proof, but
what's my intuition say?
Yes.
My intuition says it was most likely intentional for population control, even though the mass of scientific evidence that I have republished, reprinted, documented thoroughly in the book is that it was an accident waiting to happen. The biohazard and containment of these people were abysmal. And so what they were doing in terms of experimentation on human subjects, given contaminated monkeys and chimpanzees from Litton Bionetics, major army biological weapons contracting firm that supplied the monkeys contaminated as they were to the vaccine manufacturers at Merck Sharp and Dohme, and who worked with the FDA and the Centers for Disease Control. I mean, it was an accident waiting to happen, no doubt. And that it doesn't, in my opinion, even if the AIDS epidemic had been intentional, we still have to explain all of the other infectious diseases, new plagues that we're looking at today, including epidemics of cancer, that are related to the specific viruses that they were working with in their labs, including prostate, including breast, including the herpes-type viruses, which, again, in the late 70s, all of a sudden we had a herpes problem in the human race that never existed prior to that. We had chronic fatigue immune dysfunction syndrome, which evolved exactly at the same time, 1978, the same year that the AIDS epidemic broke, so did chronic fatigue immune dysfunction. So you could literally argue that had it been intentional, then how do we explain herpes, chronic fatigue, these new waves, epidemics of cancers? So that all of that really argues very thoroughly for the accidental transmission theory, back to that same implicated vaccine, which I cite is the 1974 experimental hepatitis B vaccine that was given to gay men in New York City, blacks in Central Africa, Eastern Zaire, and Northwest Uganda, and Willowbrook State School mentally retarded children on Staten Island. Now, having said that, that's why I feel like I'm uncomfortable. I mean, intuitively, what my gut feeling is that, yes, this could have been intentional, but there's a tremendous amount of evidence that would suggest it was purely an accident. And the fact that these people who are implicated had a population control agenda, had for decades been targeting minority America, to this very day continue to target minority populations. And, you know, I just came from the Castro area of San Francisco, your beautiful city here. And what do I see on the street corner? But a full big advertisement for hepatitis B vaccines. Get tested for hepatitis B and get vaccinated. I mean, this is the same garbage that people were giving the gay people in New York City in the early 1970s that led to the volunteering of 1,000 gay men in New York for the first experimentation with hepatitis B vaccines, which I show you in the book, clearly were incredibly contaminated.
And here it is 20 years later.
Yeah, we're doing the same thing. Yeah, but I mean, that's quite honestly, I mean, Alan Cantwell and I are good friends. I have many gay friends, but quite honestly, here I am. I'm proud to be in San Francisco. And as far as I'm concerned, the gay folks out there, you know, they are exactly like the Jews who were marshaled into the concentration camp gas chambers by the millions with the same attitude, oh, this could not be happening. And in fact, it's the same people with the same agendas virtually, with the same money behind it, that claim the same thing, that this they're going into those gas chambers for, quote, disinfection, public health. Well, you know, in my opinion at this point, it's like people who don't have eyes to see and ears to hear this information, in my opinion, deserve in their ignorance to succumb to whatever their choices lead them to. And if they want to walk into the concentration camp gas chambers, which today, in my opinion, are the public health settings in the physicians' offices, and the vaccines are like the gas of yesteryear, then you guys go right ahead, because as far as I'm concerned, you know, you are brainwashed and brained dead.
The refuters of the AIDS biowarfare theory always say it couldn't have happened that way because we didn't have the technology back in the 1970s.
Hogwash.
However, in your book, you talk about how the Secretary of War under Franklin Roosevelt, Secretary of War Stimson, appointed a civilian agency under George Merck of Merck Pharmaceutical fame to do biological warfare research in the 40s, and that what Merck and his associates began doing was developing recombinant DNA research techniques through which certain organisms were cloned to produce sometimes weaker, sometimes stronger mutations of the original. This information, if it's true, would tend to make liars and fools out of the refuters, but I mean, that issue aside, how far did that research go in the 1940s, and what were Merck and his friends creating in their labs back then?
Well, actually, it had gone pretty far already in the 40s, because don't forget the first virus isolation was the Rouse sarcoma virus from chickens. This was back in the 1920s. And so by the late 40s, Germany was known to have, and Hitler's group had Erich Traub, Hitler's top biological weapons developer and one of the world's leading virologists. And it was Henry Kissinger and General Bolling who...
Wait a minute. They were actually isolating viruses in the 20s?
Oh, yes. They started to begin to understand that the chicken sarcoma virus was the first virus isolated that could cause sarcoma cancers in chickens.
Okay, and how far had they actually started cloning things in the 1940s?
They started cloning things in the 50s. They started cloning cells that were infected with viruses in the 50s, and that then when the cells themselves were cloned with the viruses inside them, the viruses along with the cells became cloned. And that was published. This is published scientific documents.
So when they say they didn't have the technology in the 70s,
that's
clearly not true.
That's total disinformation, and I'm glad you point that out, Richard, because that is truly the defense that Dr. Robert Gallo cited when I questioned him on this at the 11th International Conference on AIDS in Vancouver on July 10th, when I had the privilege of becoming the first investigator in the history of the esteemed International AIDS Conference to present a scientific paper saying that these viruses, HIV and its relatives, are undoubtedly laboratory creations. So I had the opportunity to question Gallo, and that's precisely what he stated. There were four arguments. As a matter of fact, since the last time I saw you, I don't think I mentioned the fact that I had interviewed Gallo. And we are about to publish, by September for sure, the new edition of Emerging Viruses will be out, wherein we will have the Gallo interview. And I will show you that this man is absolutely a fraud, complete fraud. When it comes to the question, could they have and or did they develop immune system ravaging viruses, specifically AIDS-like viruses, in their laboratories in the late 60s and early 70s. They did. And
you asked him that question.
Well, yes. That's why he called
and
me.
And what was his answer?
His answer was four. He had four major objections, which subsequently I researched all four, and they are all bogus. And I have now the scientific documentation. He would be laughed at. His arguments are scientifically indefensible. So, but one of them was what you're pointing out. He said that, quote, "We couldn't have produced the AIDS virus in our labs in the early 1970s because, quote, we did not have the sophisticated molecular genetic biotechnology capabilities that would have allowed us to construct this virus gene per gene until the 1975, end quote. Now, is that true? Well, unfortunately, Alexander Graham Bell did not need fiber optics to make his first telephone call either. And what I show you is that between 65 and 1975, the period that also Laurie Garrett conveniently completely misses in her book called The Coming Plague. Of course, I show you in my book she was funded by the Sloan Foundation to produce that, again, largely disinformative book. Sloan Foundation gave Robert Gallo many of the reagents that he used to develop these types of viruses along with Litton Bionetics researchers. But at any rate, I show you that they undoubtedly used crude methods to recombine these different animal cancer immune ravaging viruses in their labs. And then once they had used these crude methods to recombine them, it was a tedious task to separate and isolate the different recombinants and then test each one. Now, if you go into the definitive textbook on bioweapons, it's called Bioweapons, Biological and Toxic Weaponry, published by Oxford University Press, 1986, wherein the contributor to the AIDS section or the bioweapons section is the world's leading bioweapons expert. His name is David Baltimore. He used to be at MIT until about a month ago. He moved from MIT to become president of Caltech, at which point it came out in the Herald Tribune that he now was creating the Pasadena, Los Angeles area as the next biotechnology corridor. This David Baltimore published a section in this textbook saying that indeed the AIDS virus was being considered and researched as a biological weapon.
He specifically said the AIDS virus?
Yes. Yes. And, moreover, he says the same exact thing that I'm saying, that between 1965 and 1975, they were using crude methods to evaluate these types of microorganisms for germ warfare. And ultimately, I conclude, the AIDS virus is not a good bioweapon, and he basically says the same thing, but he says they found it to be an excellent psychological warfare tool.
In what respect?
Well, you think about it. When gay men initially were targeted with GRID, or given the name gay-related immune deficiency. Okay, that was the first name for AIDS. And then it came out that it was this whole AIDS issue was associated with gay men. What kind of response did you get from the Christian right? This was God's plague. This is God's
God's
revenge
against
gay sodomists.
Right.
So, you see, this is what we do, though. I can't believe gay men are typically so intelligent that they would have the wool pulled over their eyes and be separated from everyone else like in this way and be divided and conquered. And this is typical of what they do. What this counterintelligence propaganda, disinformation does, these people are experts at separating the various social, political factions. They separate gay from straight, black from white, rich from poor, Democrat, Republican, HIV positive, HIV negative. They separate communist versus capitalist versus socialist. And look who's pulling all of the strings. It's the same.
Divide and conquer.
Exactly right. They divide the sheeple to conquer the flock. And I cannot believe, I'm standing in this city. I was just in the Castro district. And I cannot believe that these intelligent men are so blind.
On our next program, we'll bring you part two of our interview with Dr. Leonard Horowitz, author of Emerging Viruses. Before we leave you today, however, we'd like to bring you some very special greetings from across the Atlantic.
I want to say hello to the members of the Foodnot Bombs group in the United States, and I'm here in Tübingen in Germany, and I like your ideas and work and vision very much, and keep on going.
My name is Alexandra, and many greetings to the activists of Foodnot Bombs.
Hello, ich bin Henrik aus Deutschland und ich grüße Foodnot Bombs in Amerika.
Bernie in London, from Australia. Yeah. Foodnot Bombs is becoming quite well known about in Australia, and inspiring countercultural and anarchist activists over there. And we've heard about their stuff, and we just wish them the best of luck.
I'm Lily.
Hi, I'm Leonie. We're from Foodnot Bombs, Tübingen, in Germany. And we're saying hello to all of you, and we love you. And
hello, I'm Koen. I'm cooking for Foodnot Bombs tonight.
This is Sarah from Belgium. And, we're cooking now for Foodnot Bombs.
My name is Joseph Seda. I just hear CT is calling, speaking us about Foodnot Bombs. We here now in France, we think America is a big state, which is control of the world. We are afraid this virus will come to us, but I'm sure Foodnot Bombs make a good work, and Richard also. And what I want to say is, my English is quite bad. Keep going, guys and girls and everybody there. Okay, keep going. I love you. Bye-bye.
Greetings from the European chapters of Foodnot Bombs, England, France, Belgium, and Germany. Copies of this and our next program, featuring part two of our interview with Dr. Leonard Horowitz, can be ordered for $10 plus $2 postage and handling. Send your check to the Foodnot Bombs Radio Network, 750 La Playa, LAPLAYA, Box 852, San Francisco, California, 94121. That's the Foodnot Bombs Radio Network. 750 La Playa, LAPLAYA, Box 852, San Francisco, California, 94121. And again, you get two programs for $10 plus $2 postage and handling. The music on this program is by Material, featuring voice narration by William S. Burroughs. For the Food Not Bombs Radio Network, I'm Richard Edmondson.
You reckon hell who leave me out? When me you fly, I am the wings. Lands is by definition the most dangerous road in the world, for it is a journey beyond death.